Support for Tested comes from Duke Health, reminding listeners that COVID-19 vaccines are safe, effective, and can protect individuals and others from the virus. Together, communities can end this pandemic. Find sites for a free vaccine at dukehealth.org.
Hey, it's Laura Pelliser. I'm a digital reporter at WUNC, and I love that you pressed play on today's episode of Tested. I promise you will get an excellent episode in just a moment, but first, I want to thank you, because listening is the top way to support the on-demand content we make at North Carolina Public Radio. Another way is to become a sustaining member of WUNC with a monthly donation that helps fuel the power of public media. Listeners like you who donate make what we do possible. And that includes all of our podcasts, like Tested, Embodied, the WUNC Politics Podcast, Great Grief, and the one dearest to my heart, Creep. I co-host Creep with journalist Elizabeth Friend, and we're both fascinated by creatures that have come to call the South home, all while changing the environment around them. We wrapped our first season of Creep with an episode that remains our most popular, on a species that most people want nothing to do with. The folks at Tested said I could share it with you today, so here's that intriguing episode. I hope you enjoy. And for more information on how to make a donation or become a monthly sustainer, visit WUNC.org right now. Thanks for listening. Recently, while driving in Los Angeles, Monique surprised her girlfriend Emily with a question.
Emily.
Yes.
How do you feel about rats?
Ah! Why would you do this to me? I hate rats.
Did you know that Los Angeles is one of the most rat-infested cities in America?
Really? I mean, I can't say that that surprises me. But I thought New York would top us.
They might. Oh. Per square rat capita.
Yeah, per square foot, I'm sure. I'm sure that New York has more rats than LA.
I live in New York City, which is surprising that it doesn't top the list of cities that has the most rats, but it does come in at number three, so we're still crushing it on that front. You see them on the subway platforms, you see them down in the subway tracks, like they're disgusting.
That's Robin. And the list she and Monique and Emily are talking about, that's the annual ranking of America's rattiest cities, published by pest control company Orkin. In 2020, LA and New York came in second and third. The city with the dubious distinction of first place, which has topped the list for 6 years running, is Chicago.
The 50 cities on that list span the continental United States, from Burlington, Vermont, to Portland, Oregon, to Houston, Raleigh, Atlanta, and West Palm Beach, Florida. Very different places with something disturbing in common: an outsized rat population.
This is Creep, stories about creatures invading our space and changing the world around us. I'm Laura Pelliser.
And I'm Elizabeth Friend.
Rats have followed us across the entire globe. There are even rats in, you know, base camps and research stations in Antarctica.
That's Mike Cove, the research curator of mammals at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences.
I'm a conservation biologist at heart, so the majority of my research goes towards studying the ecology of different species to better inform their management and ultimately their conservation.
Rats have been living alongside us for so long, we likely forget that they're an invasive species. They're an early example of how global trade and human travel provide pathways that transport enterprising creatures all over the world.
They basically just hitched rides on ships and all different types of transport vehicles all across the globe for many centuries, if not millennia.
The Norway rat showed up in England in the 18th century. Observers thought the rat was hitching a ride on ships carrying lumber from Norway, hence the name. But in truth, the rodent came from Asia long before that time, and likely traveled to Europe along with luxurious Asian imports. Not long after, the not-so-Norwegian rats landed in North America. They're also called brown rats, sewer rats, water rats, or wharf rats. And this rat began to muscle out many of its smaller cousins, like the black rat, also called roof rat, another invasive that made the trek from Asia to Europe centuries before.
Roof rats are still among us, causing problems. They're especially fond of warmer environments near salt water, so they're often found in port cities or coastal areas. But when you think of a large rodent skittering through metropolitan alleyways at night, it's likely the Norway rat you're picturing.
Some place like a city is just a giant buffet for them. You know, being able to hop in the dumpsters, literally ride subways to other sites, and just travel through all these networks of pipes and sewer lines underneath the city, and really only coming up at night when a lot of people aren't around to even notice. Rats are super opportunistic and can capitalize on any of our resources that we provide for them, and so they can get incredibly large.
Rats will eat just about anything that can possibly be considered food. And some things like soap, leather, and dog poop that most creatures would not consider to be food. They're opportunistic eaters, and they're also predatory. Rats will hunt down other rodents, birds, eggs, reptiles, even fish if they can get them. And if food is really scarce, they'll eat each other.
And what is it about the rat that freaks you out, like, as an animal?
We're kind of like told that they carry all kinds of diseases and stuff, that they only exist in spaces that are like filthy for the most part. But also they're just they're the invaders. They just like pop up out of nowhere and they surprise you like a horror movie. They're just like somewhere they're not supposed to be and like ravaging your kitchen.
Pixar has done its part romanticizing a rat's place in the kitchen. But for the real picture, ask Fredo. He's a chef living in New Orleans, which is currently the 21st rattiest city in America, up 6 places from last year. Fredo's worked in many restaurants, and he's meticulous when it comes to keeping a clean workspace. But he also knows no kitchen is truly safe when it comes to rats.
Those days, we could smell it, but we just couldn't pinpoint it. I pulled out the refrigerator. I'd move the reaching coolers, move the ovens around. You know, I just couldn't get it. And one day, I don't know what happened, but we kind of got a whiff and noticed it might be coming from the roof. So before service started, I can't remember what day of the week it was, but before service, my boss gets the ladder and he goes up, climbs up, and he pushes the little panel over and whoop, there it is. The smell, we found it. We knew it was in there. So basically he had to get a garbage bag. He had to get some gloves. You know, this thing was rant. It was, ain't no telling how long it's been up there, but he gets it down. And when he gets it down, the rat was the size of a football, no lie, how swollen it was.
Poison is a favorite method of dealing with rat infestations, but poison has a way of spreading beyond its intended target.
Baits and things can have really, really strong negative effects throughout the ecosystem. They can't be specific just to the invasive house rats, right? So all of our native rodents are going to be eating these and also get sick and die. And it also works its way up the food web.
Rats are cautious, unlikely to eat unfamiliar foods, making it hard to convince them to take the bait. Beyond that, it's unlikely poison would be enough to make a dent in fast-growing rat populations. A single female rat can have half a dozen litters each year, each with up to 12 pups, and her babies will be ready to breed in about 3 to 4 months.
With their voracious appetites and remarkable rate of reproduction, these invasive rodents pose a serious threat to biodiversity. They're estimated to have played a role in at least 75 extinctions of bird, reptile, and mammal species worldwide.
Rats are probably not going anywhere. And I think the important issue to focus on for conservation and invasion biology right now is to manage rats where we can and where it's most critical.
So, if we're stuck with rats in our cities and suburbs, what about places where it's not too late to limit their spread? To find out, we're heading south, all the way down to South Georgia.
But maybe not the South Georgia you're thinking of.
It's pitch black, the stars are shining. I'm just getting Sammy loaded up into the car. Come on.
Meet Naomi Cordero. She's a biosecurity dog handler working for the Falkland Islands and South Georgia Island.
Ready? Come up. Good lad.
They're very far south, not too distant from the Antarctic Circle. During winter, they can see just 3 hours of sunlight a day.
So we're just heading down to the public jetty to meet the boat.
The Falklands are a collection of more than 700 islands at the tip of South America, roughly 400 miles off the coast of Argentina. Fewer than 4,000 people live on the islands, which altogether are about the size of the state of Connecticut. South Georgia Island is even more remote. Located over 900 miles southeast of the Falklands, the rocky island has no permanent human residents, but plenty of seals, penguins, and the world's only sub-Antarctic songbird. Part of Naomi's job is to patrol islands that have been cleared of invasive rats and mice, to make sure they haven't been reinfested.
We're in a little inlet. It's really, really rocky with steep sides and tussock right up the top and sort of all the way down at the back in a kind of gully is kelp in the water. So it's quite hard to get a little boat in with a motor, but we managed it.
Today, she's visiting a couple islands in the Falklands she hasn't been able to check out yet this year. But she can't do this work alone. She relies on the keen judgment of her co-worker, Sammy. Sammy is a golden, fluffy-tailed Shiba Inu dog, specially trained to alert his handler to the presence of rodent feces, or live rodents. Rats and mice were first transported to these islands on whaling ships in the 1700s.
Humans also brought along a host of other invasive species, including cats, foxes, feral swine, and even reindeer, which, unlike the rats, really did come from Norway.
The rats were especially hard on the native birds, decimating their populations by eating the eggs and chicks of species like the tussock bird, Cobb's wren, and several types of burrowing petrels. And, ever opportunistic, the rats were able to use one of the key features of the Falklands habitat to their benefit, the dense, clumping tussock grass that covers some of the islands instead of trees.
I've seen some tussock birds and Cobb's wren, which are a really good sign that this is a rodent-free island, which is what we expected.
In the past 2 decades, there's been a push to eradicate rodents from some of the many islands they've invaded. It's a painstaking effort that involves hand-seeding poisonous bait over a large area, or delivering it via helicopter in harsh sub-Antarctic conditions, then checking and rechecking for years after to make sure no rats have returned. On these windswept islands in the far South Atlantic, it can be cold, windy work.
So now onto our second island of the day. We just got dropped off on Bottom Island. Just as we were jumping onto the rocks there and scrambling up towards the tussock, a little tussock bird came and sat on the bow, which was really lovely. And, you know, just a really nice sign that there's probably no rodents here. So give Sammy a good chance to have a sniff around. But there's other signs as well, the tussock birds, the cobs around, that give us confidence that this isn't an island with rats on. See if we can get started. Okay, you ready? Find it.
When Sammy smells a rodent, he's trained to send a signal. A whiff of urine or fur is enough to make him sit and point his jet black nose in the direction of the scent. When he finds a live rodent, he gets excited, wagging his curly tail.
Back on the boat after searching Bottom Island, and there were no rats to find, which is great news. We saw plenty of tusset birds, no Cobb's wren, unfortunately. So Sammy's done a really good job today. He's very tired. He didn't find anything, but he still gets a little reward when we get back to the boat or back to the car, just for having done his job. So it's not his fault we didn't find anything. So he's just giving himself a little clean, licking his paws, and the sun's come out now, which is really nice. So we're just going to cruise back into Stanley, and then Sammy can go and have a little nap.
I caught up with Naomi afterwards via Zoom at her house in Stanley, on the main island of East Falkland.
So we're just back home after our search today. I'm just going to give Sammy some biscuits and then we'll just relax for a little bit. Sammy usually has a kind of crazy half hour after he's been working, so that's still to come.
She lives there with her husband, a cat, a dog, and of course, her co-worker Sammy.
He's quite an unusual, particular little creature. He's kind of cat-like. He's a bit aloof, you know, he doesn't really sort of come to you for a cuddle unless he really, really wants one, or if he really, really likes you.
In addition to checking islands for evidence of rats and mice, a big part of Naomi and Sammy's work is checking cargo ships, cruise ships, fishing ships, the ferry that goes between the Falkland Islands, and anything headed to South Georgia.
We sort of try and search as much of the vessel as we can, but we kind of focus on areas like the provisions around the galley, waste storage areas, and then any areas where the mooring lines come from the dock onto the vessel, around that area. So if a rat or a mouse had climbed up the ropes and then got onto the vessel, you know, we think, well, where could it have stowed away? So we check all those little nooks and crannies in around there.
Naomi and Sammy go out on a small boat to meet cargo and cruise ships at sea, before they reach the Falklands, and well before any crew members, tourists, or rats can disembark. If they do find evidence of rodents, government inspectors are called in to decide if the problem warrants sending the ships away to keep them from landing on rodent-free areas.
Most of the time, if there's rats on the boat, they can't go. If there's any doubt, it's not worth the risk, so they won't be allowed out.
In the Falklands, some islands are currently infested. There are some where the rodents have been eradicated, and a few they never got to in the first place. It's a balancing act to keep the problem from spreading, one made harder by the amazing adaptability of rats.
They're really good swimmers. Yeah, and that's one of the problems with doing the eradications around the Falklands is a lot of the islands are within the swimming distance of rats, and they were just recolonized after eradication. They can swim far. I think it's over a kilometer. It's really far. It's incredible.
According to biosecurity researchers in the UK, a half-mile swim is no problem for a Norway rat. Even a 2.5-mile swim can't be ruled out. And if need be, they can tread water for up to 3 days. At 900-plus miles to the southeast, rats aren't swimming to South Georgia Island, but the stakes there are even higher. Though there are no permanent human settlements on the remote island, there's still plenty of boat traffic from fishing ships, scientific researchers, and tourists who hope to glimpse seals, giant albatrosses, and some of the largest penguin colonies on the planet.
The idea of doing the inspections in the Falklands is that they're still hundreds of miles away from South Georgia.
The multi-million-dollar effort to clear rats and mice from South Georgia was the largest rodent eradication project ever undertaken in the world. It took 7 years to clear 420 square miles. The project wrapped up in 2018, and as Naomi points out, the timing was critical.
It's a bit of a sad story. There was a really good opportunity to do it because the rats were in certain areas separated by glaciers. And as the glaciers retreated, the rats would make their way into new areas. So if they did it, and they did it just before 2018, then it would be less work than doing it when they had got across the whole island. This was the time to do it before they could get further with the melting ice.
By monitoring vessels headed to South Georgia, Naomi and Sammy are a crucial line of defense for this protected wildlife haven. No one wants to risk undoing years of eradication efforts, so no ship on the way to South Georgia is allowed to leave the Falklands unless it's clear that there are zero rodents on board. When Naomi and Sammy come aboard to screen a vessel, there's a lot riding on their teamwork. Rats have a long history with humans, and they are widely reviled. But Mike Cove, from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, reminded me there are other ways to think about them.
I wonder if there are ways in which rats are useful to humans. I'll say I came up with two, and that was like species for study in the lab and some make good pets. That's about it. It's as far as I got.
Probably the vast majority of all of our medical breakthroughs as a society have come from research on two species, right? The house mouse, Mus musculus, and the brown rat, Rattus norvegicus. Rats are super smart, right? They are actually incredibly smart. And that's also a big component of why they're so successful as well. And so they do actually make good pets. You can train rats to do all types of things. They are really unique and cool species. The other thing that we don't typically think about in kind of our Western culture is that rats actually make good food. You know, rodents are a delicacy in many parts of the world. Rats and rodents in general, actually quite tasty, but they're most tasty when they're eating their natural diets, right? They're eating seeds and plants and fruits, maybe some insects and things like that. So the old saying, you are what you eat, you know, we're not going to want to eat these New York City sewer rats, right? But if we ate those rats in their natural habitat with what they were consuming in terms of, you know, natural seeds and fruits, the meat actually would be tasty because it carries over kind of that nuttiness from their natural diets.
It's possible that one day artisanal, hand-fed, organic rat could be a sought-after menu item in the U.S., but not pizza rat. We'll leave that one to live its best life in the New York subways.
Let's take a step back and think about biological invasions more broadly. One framework for considering how communities can deal with an invasive species is to look at four ways we might respond, depending on how well established the species has become. The first level of response is prevention. The goal here is monitoring known threats and entry points to keep invasive species out of your area, like what Naomi and Sammy are doing to keep rodents off of South Georgia Island.
If an invasive species does show up, the next level of response is early detection and eradication, essentially to get rid of the species before it gets a foothold. For species that have already gained that foothold, we can try to limit their spread through containment.
Finally, if a species is so widespread it can't be contained, we have to focus on protecting key resources from further harm. For much of the United States, and in fact, much of the world, we fall squarely in that last category when it comes to rats. We can only hope to mitigate the damage rats do to humans, plants, animals, and the wider environment.
But for some key places, mostly remote or isolated spots like islands, there's this opportunity to erase past damage and protect sensitive plants and animals. From palm-covered atolls in the Pacific to what used to be known as Rat Island in Alaska, there are efforts underway to reclaim these places from the plague of rats and rebuild their native ecosystems.
As long as humans keep moving around the world, we'll keep bringing other creatures with us, some of which will go on to cause problems in their new habitats. Prevention is hard work, and it's not always easy to convince people to mobilize against a threat that hasn't shown up yet. But once invasive species take root, all the other steps to deal with them become even more complex, expensive, and hard to achieve.
I think that it's very easy for us to kind of, you know, keep our heads down and continue with the status quo and not accept that, you know, something is becoming a problem until it's really in our faces. And I think in a lot of instances, that is why we're in the position we're in with many of the invasive species that we have, you know, here in the U.S., for example.
Mike Cove understands that if Naomi and Sammy were to stop their daily work, the situation could get out of hand fast. Layer in the pressures of a warming planet, and unchecked invasives become even more of a threat to the ecosystem. As he and other experts contemplate the future, he's got a prime example in mind as a stark warning for what could happen here in the U.S.
The Burmese pythons in the Everglades continue to expand their, you know, invasion front, right? And, you know, the scary thing about that is if you look at the models and projections with climate change, but also contemporary climate data, Burmese pythons have the potential to colonize the entire southeastern United States.
Creep is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, in partnership with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Learn more about all the invasives we've been talking about at wunc.org/creep. We'd love it if you wrote us a review and shared Creep with a friend who's curious about the world around us. And there's also another easy way to support this podcast. Visit wunc.org/give and make a donation in any amount. Your support can mean more deep dives into mysterious creatures.
Many thanks to science communicator Eleanor Spicer Rice for helping to review and provide scientific feedback for this episode. Thanks also to Monique Laborde, Robin Gelfenbein, and Katie Fernelius, who brought us the voices from some of America's rattiest cities. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer, Amanda Magnus is our editor, Jenny Lawson is our audio engineer, and Lindsay Foster Thomas is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. I'm Elizabeth Friend.
And I'm Laura Pelliser.